Welcome. I'm Gary Parr. You're listening to Fiber Talk. Before we get to our conversation with Anna Scott of Anna Scott Embroidery, I want you to know that the show is made possible by Sassy Jack Stitchery and the Embroiderers Guild of America. And if you are new to Sassy Jack Stitchery or haven't checked in in a while, there's lots going on there. Kim has just started carrying the full line of Avalia cross-stitch and embroidery designs. That's Krista West at Avalia, and she's been on our show a couple, three times, and now Kim is carrying her line, so be sure and check that out. Lots of events coming up at Sassy Jack's. In August, there will be an online workshop with Susan Greening Davis, and she's a treat. You don't want to miss that, so sign up for that. Then in November, a workshop, another online workshop, Summer House Stitch Works, and then the 2020 workshop with Linda Vincent of Needle Made Designs. Now, that's been moved to 2021, so you'll want to go to sassyjackstitchery.com to stay on top of that. And there'll be two projects back-to-back when Linda does her workshop. And then remember now, the September Soiree live event has been canceled, but that's actually a big plus because it's now going to be a huge online event in September. And registration is now open again, so you can sign up for that. Don't miss out. Kim has a ton of things planned for September online soiree, and Fiber Talk will also be part of that. And then also coming soon, I'm pretty excited about this because I've seen the Treenway silks at the Nashville show, and Kim is going to start carrying those. So if you're at all interested in Treenway silks, Kim is going to be your source for that. And they are absolutely fantastic threads, so be sure and check that out. Best thing to do, go to sassyjackstitchery.com, sign up for the newsletter, and then also go to Facebook and become a member of the Sassy Jack Stitchery group, and you will stay up to date with everything that's going on with Kim and the folks there at Sassy Jack's. Our other sponsor for this show is the Embroiderers Guild of America. And always glad to have them with us. I'm really glad I joined as a member at large. And EGA is a community of stitch-minded people who inspire passion for the needle arts through education and celebration of its heritage. And you're encouraged to join. You can join through a local guild. There are local guilds all over the country. But you can also do what I did, and that's become a member at large. And then you don't have any local affiliation, but you get all the benefits of EGA, and that works best for me and my schedule because another meeting and another night is just difficult for me, but I really wanted to be a member of the EGA. And so their website, egausa.org, that website is fantastic. Online classes are posted regularly. Free projects are located there. You can all kinds of free projects. I want you to notice a couple of upcoming online courses. One is Awani by Loreen Salt. That's a counted canvas project, and that registration ends July 29. That is one beautiful piece. And then The Stitcher's Touch with Dawn Donnelly. That registration opens August 5. Now, that opens August 5. And then also a beautiful piece from Curtie Biggs, Creme de la Creme Box. So you stitch all sides of a box, and then you construct it. That registration opens September 2. So go to egausa.org, check out all these things, consider becoming a member, and do spend some time in the gallery. It is an absolute visual treat there. And so thanks to Kim at Sassy Jack's and the good folks at the Embroiderers Guild of America for sponsoring this show. And now we will enjoy a conversation I had with Anna Scott. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Anna Scott Embroidery. Anna Scott. Hi, Anna.
Hello, Gary. Lovely to be on your show.
Oh, thanks for doing this. Kangarilla, Australia.
That's right. Sitting on a very, very cold winter's morning in South Australia.
Yes, and we're sitting in some of the hot, recording this in some of the hottest days of the summer for us. It's so strange. Yeah.
Yeah, it is very odd.
Anybody who looks at what you've done would say you do all of the hard techniques. I mean, embroidery, stump work, gold work, cut work. How is it that you migrate to that? Did you, you certainly didn't start out doing those techniques. What was your start?
Well, my very, very, very earliest embroidery memory is, I would have been about 3 or 4, and I was reading out cross-stitch charts to my grandma stitching. But other than that, as a child, I had my own first embroidery attempt. I remember it going flying through the living room in a tangled mess, and that was about the end of my early embroidery adventures. I don't know. I guess through the way I was later trained, we covered a lot of different techniques, and I very quickly discovered that many stitches can easily migrate from one to the other, and many stitches are used equally well in various techniques. And I guess, admittingly, I do like a bit of a challenge, so that's part of what those techniques represent as well. So I know when I present my work, it is categorized as technique based, but to me, in all, it's all embroidery. It's various tools to create different expressions, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that was the impression that I got just in preparing for this, was that it's whatever for you, it's whatever technique gets the job done, doesn't really matter. Yes. It's what expresses what you're looking for.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. So with the items that end up for sale, most of those I started out as class kits, or things that have been published have been on request, can we get something in such and such a technique? So that's why they often end up very technique based. When occasionally I have time to do a piece of embroidery just for my own pleasure, they will merge everything into one at times, and there's no borders, so to speak, as to which techniques or names. At the end of the day, it's all embroidery, needle in one spot, needle out another, and you create a stitch. So right. It's those classifications to me sort of they blur a bit when I do my own work.
Okay, I think we have a new term: borderless embroidery.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I think that's a new term. I'm writing that down.
So I don't know about all the hard techniques. I mean, there's a lot of cut work and white work techniques that I am aware of and that I find incredibly beautiful, but I have never mastered. And I sort of think now there's other people who are so incredibly talented in those that I'll leave them to do that. They're good at that, and I'll stick to the things that I really love. So.
Yeah, now see, I subscribe to the belief that when it comes to needlework, you can learn something from each technique, and I think you even said it. It crosses over, it applies to another technique. You benefit no matter what it is, and to me, there's real benefit overall in trying different techniques. I think you become an overall better stitcher for doing that. Yeah.
Yep. No, I agree with that. It even at times doing things that you know you may attend a class or something, and you within half an hour know that no, this is just not my thing. You still learn something that you can then take with you into the types of embroidery that you really love. There's always something to learn. So I will always say to people, stitch with as many tutors as you can. You'll pick something up from everybody that will benefit your own work.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So it was your grandma that got you exposed to it? Was she your principal educator?
Well, all the women growing up, both of my grandmothers and my mother and my auntie, were all very sort of handy, some of them very, very clever needlewomen with knitting, crochet, sewing, all sorts of things. But if anyone, when I was growing up, had told me that I was going to end up doing what I do now, I would have told them to go and jump in a lake, I think. It was not something I ever planned or set out to do at all. So it has been a journey that's been a bit of a surprise to myself as much as anybody else, you could say.
kind of happen to you instead of you happening to it out there, huh?
Yeah, well, I usually say I didn't choose to embroider. Embroidery chose me. I set out to study dressmaking or fashion design and construction. And as part of that course, we had a one-term module of hand embroidery and embellishment. And I did the very first lesson, went straight up to head office and changed my major to hand embroidery. It was one of those aha moments where I sat there and thought, no, this is what I have to do. So it was very odd, and I haven't really looked back since. It was the best change I ever made, I think.
Well, you know, you're not the first one I've talked to who started out in the fashion industry, and it seems like the story is I wasn't in it very long and I got out. I found something else. Which I got to believe that industry, that takes a special kind of person to survive there anyway. But so this was at school that you discovered this?
Yes. So I sort of the side path to the story is I was born in Denmark, moved to Australia in my very early 20s, was terribly homesick, and we moved back again. And there is a college in Copenhagen which directly translated is really awkward, but it is basically the Advancement of Needlecraft Arts was the original name. And it was... established around the same time as the Royal School of Needlework in the UK under a similar ethos to provide young women with a needlework education so that they could provide for themselves and their families. The two schools have developed very differently over the years. So the Needlecraft College in Copenhagen, when I attended, was geared towards training educators in various textile crafts, so there is machine knitting design and there is fabric printing and all sorts of things. But part of their major lines back then still was hand embroidery. So it was a three-year course, similar to the RSN apprenticeship courses, I think, run for 3 years. But the structure is very, very different. So rather than specialising in a few techniques and becoming a very, very skilled craftsperson within those, it covers a very broad, or covered because the course doesn't exist anymore, a very broad variety of techniques. I think over the 3 years I was there, I would have touched on maybe 25 different embroidery techniques. So that's perhaps, like you brought up, that I tend to merge everything together because I had to do things I really, really, really didn't like, but I still learned things. So that was 3 years of hard work, but I loved every minute of it. And during that time, I was lucky enough to get an internship at what would translate to the Ecclesiastical Art Society in Copenhagen. It's a very small company that provides the churches with a consultancy service to put churches in contact with arts people, both for their silver, anything they need really, but they also have a textile workroom. And I embroidered there for 3 months internship and ended up with part-time work for the remainder of my studies. So that's where I sort of learned to sit down 6, 7, 8 hours a day and just stitch.
That's your real world acid test right there, huh?
Yes. Well, that's where you get into the craftsmanship side of things, where you really just stitch and learn to focus on what you're doing and creating the best quality piece of textile that you can.
Yeah. Is there an art background that drives this? I mean, art interests all through school?
I've always drawn and played with, I've always made things. As long as I can remember, I've knitted, drawn, painted, whatever. But I still say to people, I cannot paint to save myself, which I wish I could. But no formal training in art as such. No. I've just always enjoyed patterns and colours and shapes and textures in whichever medium I had available to me at the time, I suppose.
Yeah, because that, you know, looking at your work, immediately I think, well, there's an artist behind that. There's someone with some training, understanding of color, shape, proportion, composition, all of those things are all there. So there's no formal training. It's just in you.
No, I'd take that as a wonderful compliment. Thank you. No, I haven't had any formal art training. We did a little bit of design and art as part of my studies. We had a lecturer come over from the art school, but other than that, no, it's been bits and bobs picked up along the way. I've always gravitated to colour, even as a little girl. I've always sort of played with colours and like to mix colour together and see what happens when you put one colour next to another colour. And I guess that's where what I love about embroidery, as opposed to, as I say, I can't paint. Once you mix two paints, you can't unmix them. Where I can stitch, I can put two colours next to each other, and if it doesn't work, I can pull one out and try a slightly different shade, and it immediately might change and get to where I need it to be.
Yeah, it is hard to unmix those paints, yep.
It's very tricky.
Yeah, that's a skill. You get that one, you're rich, right?
Yes.
Out of the gate, yep.
Yes, so that was how I got into stitching, was through that back door of starting a textile college to do something completely different.
So you're working at the ecclesiastical place. Did you stay with that after you finished your schooling?
No, because what happened while I was studying, I realized that having lived in Australia for 7 years and then moving back, even though all my family is still in Denmark, moving from a place where you can be outside all the time to somewhere where you can't was not as easy as I thought. So we had a young family at the time, and we decided that, no, Australia was the best place for us to be. So shortly after finishing, we moved back to South Australia, and that was scary from a career point of view, because I had just started this thing and I had made some good contacts in Denmark while I was there, and I would have had a job lined up and all that sort of thing, which in this industry, we must face it, it's fickle. It is something you have to work at to actually be able to make a living from textile in any way, shape or form. So I got the usual, well, are you going to live off, what are you going to do for a job in Australia? There's no embroidery heritage, was one I heard a lot. They don't have an embroidery tradition, so what are you going to do? How are you going to find work? And then what happened when we came back here, the first job I got was with a bridal company, and at the time there was a lot of beading on wedding gowns, so I spent a couple of years beading wedding dresses. I haven't done a lot of beading since, I must confess.
I was going to say, and you got over that.
I got very much got over rusty crystals and little pearls very quickly.
Oh, man. I feel the pain already.
Oh. So, and while I was working there, a job came up on Inspirations magazine. They were looking for someone to draft their pattern sheets. And I got an interview for that. I didn't get the job. However, a while later, a few months later, Maggie Bauer, who owned it, who founded Country Bumpkin, called me and said that one of their permanent editorial staff was going on 3 months' leave and would I like to cover? And me being me said no, because I don't want full-time work and I can't leave my job for something that's just a short contract. So that was that, and I thought about it for a bit, and I thought, that was really stupid, Anna. So I called her back, and I said, well, about this job, can we make it 4 days a week, and what are the chances of it becoming permanent? So that's how I started with Country Bumpkin, which, you know, I still think, I have no idea why she offered me that job. I had English as my second language and knew nothing at all about publishing, but... She did, Maggie did, and so I'm very grateful to her for that, because clearly getting my foot in that door has been very beneficial down the road.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Now, you contribute, I mean, you contribute regularly to Inspirations. Is that, I mean, you're just one of their go-to people?
No, I wouldn't say so. I was with them for 12, 13 years, something like that, and sort of learnt the ropes through doing it, and had quite a few bits published while I worked there. I also wrote A to Z of Gold Work and did every single sample that's in there. So that was my hard work Gold Work stint. But since leaving it, I'm still in touch with them, and they're Adelaide-based as well, so clearly we cross paths. And if I have things that I think might be suitable for the magazine, because not everything, and I know that from having worked there, not every project, as beautiful as it may be, is necessarily suitable to be published. There are things that are more publishable than others.
Right.
So if there are things that I know might interest them, I'll let them know. Sometimes they'll contact me and say, oh, look, we've got this issue coming up and we're sort of looking for something and thought maybe you are such and such. They know what I'm up to. And so it's an open communication thing. It's not I've never been very good at chasing work or putting myself out there, so to speak. So I don't really advertise much. But I'm probably quite good at when there is an opportunity to grab it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a nice channel to have. No, I'm a magazine editor, trade magazine, and I know exactly that decision process. There's only so much room, only so many things, and you have to think of what
exactly
that audience is after. And
exactly.
Yeah, there might be something that you as an editor really want, really like, but it just you can't use it because it doesn't fit the audience.
And those are awful.
Yes.
And when you have to go to the contributors and say, look, I love it, but, and it's hard to explain to people to say, look, and as you would know then too, Gary, it is every magazine, every issue, you have to find that balance of having something that will satisfy all the different categories within your readership. So
right.
You need something for those starting out. You need something for those that are more experienced. You need something for those who like something that's a bit more traditional, and you need something that can challenge those who are looking for something a little bit different. And then visually in a magazine like Inspirations, which really prides itself on its visual content, and it is, I think it is without doubt one of the most beautiful embroidery magazines out there, if not the most beautiful. So there is that visual, as you flick through it, it needs to be visually coherent. So there's a lot of considerations that are on top of choosing just well-made, beautiful pieces of embroidery.
Right.
They also all have to fit nicely together within an issue, within a certain amount of pages, because that's limited too. So.
Yeah, there's always that too, isn't there? Yeah.
Yes.
It can't be 400 pages. It just can't.
Oh, that would be wonderful at times, though.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, no, that was quite an experience working, and a steep learning curve for me working with them for that amount of time. But it was great fun for the most part.
Did that experience make you a better designer?
I don't think it has changed my design style as such, but what I did discover, which I found was really interesting, is I didn't stitch an awful lot. For a lot of that time, I would possibly do a project every now and then for the magazine, but I really didn't embroider a lot myself. However, I read a lot of instructions and I wrote a lot of instructions. So it really opened my eyes to how many different ways there is of achieving the same goal. And you pick up, and that's why I now say to my students, don't stick with the same tutor all the time. Make sure, try and do workshops, classes with as many people as you can, because we all have slightly different ways of doing something, and what works really well for me might not work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You might find another tutor who explains something in a way that makes better sense to you than the way that I have expressed it. So, and I think that's something that has come through being exposed to such a broad variety of ways of designing and presenting instructions, because that's the other thing we do, or Inspiration does. Everything is rewritten in-house in quite a structured set house style. So what was coming in, at times you would get from some designers, you'd get really quite professional and refined instructions. Others, you got a sheet of paper with a list of threads and a list of stitches and maybe a sketch of what went where. And then we had to sit with the physical embroidery and kind of work backwards, write it up, work out how it was done, which order, which stitches, and really write it up from scratch. So even without stitching, I learned a lot about embroidery while working there.
Yeah, just that process will teach you a lot. I can see that happening very quickly. Mm. Yes.
Yes, it certainly did. It certainly did.
So how do we get through to the point now where your primary business is designing and teaching? What is that process? How did that evolve?
I guess it came to a point where I felt now was my time to be creative from the development of embroideries myself. As I said, at that time, I think I had been with Inspirations 12, 14 years or something. And it just came to a point, I was teaching a little, I've had a regular group here in Adelaide for years and years and years, and I was doing the odd trip interstate, not an awful lot. And I really do enjoy the teaching part. I really love being out in those more intimate settings with a small group of people and stitch together and share what I know. And to be truthful, often I sometimes wonder who learned the most, because with students asking you questions and whatever, you have to think about your embroidery in a whole different way. You suddenly have to actually explain why you do what you do and how you do it. So, and that part of it I really enjoyed, but it was more so from the designing and the creative side of it that I felt, no, it was time for me to have more time to spend on that. I never sort of quit publishing with the thought, oh, well, I'm going to make a full-time business of this. I've never been very good at planning. I tend to take it a little bit as it comes. And thus, I haven't really pushed getting out to teach. I haven't really pushed my online store or anything like that. It's sort of taken it takes on its own little life, or it has for me, and I'm very grateful for that. And things sort of evolve and change all the time. If I try and plan something, usually something else happens anyway, or I miss an opportunity. So I take things a little bit as they come my way. So today I'm now almost a full-time business, and my husband and I also run a small vineyard in the Adelaide Hills and have another little job on the side. But for the most part, it is the embroidery and the designing.
Yeah, and isn't that the truth about teaching? If you know that old adage, if you want to learn something, try teaching it. You'll learn it.
Absolutely. And it amazes me every time I'm out that there will be something where I go back and go, I hadn't actually thought of that. And there are times where I have a student saying to me, but so and such and such a teacher had showed me how to do this way, or I got this hint from someone and I go, I never thought of that. That's a great idea. So it is very much, I find the teaching situation very, very much a two-way street. It's sort of, and that's how I like my classes to run, is that it is a two-way communication between myself and everybody else in the group.
Yeah. No, that's, I know that feeling. I'm a former science teacher long ago. Mm. And my last job was in a farm community and teaching freshman biology to a bunch of kids who grew up on the farm. There's an equal exchange going on all the time.
It would be because absolutely. You'd have that hands-on experience.
Yeah.
Coming in. Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, I can see that.
No, yeah, several times. Why don't we just have a class at the farm here, and you guys can teach it, and I'll watch. Yeah.
That would be fun.
We'll all be better off. Mm. Yep. Yep. So they, so you have from school, you have all of these techniques in your head. As you're starting to develop your business, do you also have this head full of designs and design ideas that just want to get out? Or are you poking around for inspiration and putting things together?
Now, that's a really interesting question, because that changes a lot with the purpose of what I'm designing. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of my work start life as a class project or something that, primarily for class projects, in which case I've got, even before I start there, you have certain constraints. I don't like having class projects that are so big that I know we will only get through a tenth of it during a two-day workshop, and then if people go home and it most likely ends up at the bottom of a drawer because there's too much we haven't covered enough. I like to have my class project so that I'm confident I can get through all the techniques and stitches required to complete it, even if we just have a go at everything, and people then have the confidence to finish in their own time. So that's a constraint. I will also often have, especially I teach once a year, have been very privileged to the last 6-7 years to teach once a year in Bangkok in a Thai studio there. So that's all through an interpreter, quite large groups of women. So for those, they will have, we need a new stump work project, and they're all beginners. So I have quite set parameters before I even start. So the design process for those will be, I might even start out with a list of stitches, and that's how it starts, because I know, okay, these are stitches and techniques we can get through in a two-day workshop for people who have limited embroidery skills. So we need to be. So I need to have time to both teach them the stitch itself, but also how to apply it. So there's very different. It depends where my starting point is for a design. Some designs have milled around in my head for a long time, and they kind of just brew and develop until I have time to sit down and put them down on paper. So they all start very different, Gary. Very different.
Okay. Well, I mean, because some people have that. They just have ideas spilling out of their heads, and others have an approach like you do. And so it's interesting to me, the different minds and the results that come out of that and the process, because it's different for every person. There are some people, even just in talking to them, you can tell that they just can't help it. They can't get them down fast enough. And for others, they have to brew and cook and evolve, and then they try something, and it gets set aside, and then later on it really gels for them. And different processes. It's interesting.
I would say I probably do have a head full of ideas. A lot of them I don't think about too much because I know I don't have time to do them at the moment anyway. But they're there for when something appropriate comes up and I can jot them down on paper. One that I think is quite funny, the last Beating Around the Bush conference in Adelaide, I taught a stump work lyrebird over a three-day workshop, and that particular design was actually born in my head the Beating Around the Bush prior, where I was also doing a three-day stump work workshop. And during that class, some of the students were saying, are you ever going to do an Australian animal as a stump work piece? And I'm going, no, I'm not into stitching kangaroos and koalas. And later in the class, we got, you're teaching, but there's also time for a little bit of chit-chat in between. And we got talking about, the Adelaide Zoo. And I was telling them how they used to have a lyrebird in the zoo called Chook. And for those who are not familiar with lyrebirds, they're kind of like a pheasant. They don't have a particularly pretty call, but they're incredibly good imitators. And this lyrebird Chook They were renovating the Sioux at the time, and he had learned to imitate all the power tools. So you'd be walking through the Sioux, and there's this bird sounding like a jackhammer or a chainsaw or whatever. And I was telling them about this bird, and as I was telling the story, I thought, if I was to do an Australian animal in stump work, it would definitely have to be a lyrebird. So that's sometimes all it takes for an idea to be sparked, and then that milled around in my head for a little bit exactly how I was going to do this lyrebird. So they all start completely different. I don't have a set sort of ideas process as such, and I guess that is what design is, that something inspires your mind and it starts, the cogs start ticking over and something comes out the other end with a bit of luck.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, everybody's different. I mean, it's art. It's art. So there's no set of rules. It's just get to the end piece and deliver something that's visually attractive to whomever. Yes.
Well, I hope so, yes. That's the aim, yes.
Now, do you see, when you have a design like the lyrebird, do you see that visually as a stump work or a gold work? I mean, does that mental process click in for you? Say this is best executed with this technique, or do you just let that evolve too?
So with that one, I knew that I would be doing it. No, that one straight away was okay. That's a raised embroidery. I often prefer to refer to it as raised embroidery, mostly because in my mind, stump work, I instantly see the superb caskets and mirror frames of the past with figures and things, and that's not the type of work I do. So to me, the word stump work is very strongly associated with a particular style of raised embroidery. So I tend to refer to my work as raised embroidery. That's just a side note. But no, with that one, I instantly thought, well, that needs to be dimensional, mostly because of his spectacular tail feathers, and I wanted them away from the fabric. So that was the deal breaker, really, with that one. I could probably do something equally nice with a lyrebird in cool work, say, or in wools. But it will be a completely different expression because of the materials and techniques that you use. So it would look very, very different.
Right, right. Mm. Now, you take, because some of the techniques you use, now, for instance, gold work,
yes.
I've barely dabbled in that. And that's, you know, very high precision, very careful work. And then some of the others don't require near that much. Do you enjoy one over the other?
No, and that's probably another reason why I chop and change a little bit. I haven't done a piece of gold work in a while, and one thing I do enjoy about that is that you have to really immerse yourself and focus and be very precise in your stitching, which to me, my sort of other life is very busy and I really don't have a lot of patience, but it's something where you have to sit down and just focus. So for me, it becomes almost meditative. Mm-hmm. And I really do love that. I do find though with gold work, as much as I love it, I'm fully aware that there are some very, very skilled gold workers out there who technically, from a technical point of view, are much more skilled than I am because I don't do it enough. It is a style of embroidery. I think we do need to practice it regularly to get that precision really spot on. So in another life, that's maybe something I would like to spend some more time on. Getting back to why I chop and change, I think that is it. I'll get to the end of a stump work piece, for instance, which is very fine and delicate, and I think, oh my goodness, I need to get up on my big frame and do a bit of crawl work where I don't need my strong glasses, and I think that's of the three is the one that is the most relaxing, that I don't have to focus as strongly. So
that's your mindless stitching is crawl work.
Well, I don't know if mindless is the right word, but it's my most relaxed one. It's the one where I sort of can loosen up a bit, and then once I get to the end of that, I get now I need something that's a little bit more challenging. So my order of stitching is almost a piece of crewel work, a piece of stump work, a piece of crewel work, maybe a piece of gold work. So I will throw the the wool in there.
Yeah.
Between the three, partially because it is the more relaxing for me to do, but also it is the one I just enjoy the free-flowing patterns, and I do love to play the stitches and that sort of thing. So, and that opens up the scope for that a little bit more. It's the stitching process of the crewel to me is more. Is more flowy, it's more lucid in a way, because I don't plan it from start. I have the line drawing and I have a rough idea of colours and where they go, but that's as much planning as goes into it. The rest of it happens on the linen while I stitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That term, mindless stitching, that is probably is a terrible term, but it's what I use when I want something that the other side of my brain can be doing something else.
Yes, yes. No, yeah. I didn't mean it in a bad way, because it is mindless in the sense you don't have to focus on what you're doing to the same extent. You don't have to concentrate as heavily.
Right. Right. Do you find that within each technique you're very much a purist in terms of how it's executed, or do you let that wander a little bit depending on what you're trying to achieve?
I'll probably let it wander a little bit, not as much as again, that comes back to what's the purpose of the piece I'm stitching. If it's a piece that's going to go into a kit or a class project, it is a bit more purist. I don't know if you had a bit of a look around my website. There's a picture on there that I did.
Yeah, you owe me 3 hours of my life. Yes, I did.
So there's some figures on there, but there's also a piece, and I will say large, it's roughly 20 by 30, and it's completely covered in stitches. It's a red desert scene with just a single tree in there. And that was that. The stitching in that is completely blurred. There's a stump tree work, the same as you would a stump work. It's got wire aperture underneath it and bits sticking out, but then you've got a massive ground of red hills that are all various filling techniques and stitches, and then there's a mighty big blue sky that's all just very long split stitches to cover the background. So when I do those types of things that are just for me, and likewise with the Little Mermaid that I just blogged about recently, those pieces become about expression because they're not going to be taught. I'm doing them purely for my own pleasure or to give away as a gift or whatever. So I don't have any boundaries as to what I can and can't do. I can do whatever I like. Where pieces that are going into to become kits or to class projects, they are a bit more limited. I don't blur the line quite as much.
Yeah. That mermaid thing, I ended up reading all of your blog posts on that. That was an interesting journey, because you ended up just setting it aside, right? I mean, still?
Yes, well, I have finished it now. Well, it was, and I'm kicking myself over it, but it was all my own undoing, and it's a very good example of if you're going to participate in something, make sure you read all the criteria thoroughly before you start. So those of your listeners who are not aware of it, I'll put my hand up to be part of a arts project by a Dutch artist who made a call out for embroiderers all over the world to do a piece of embroidery in gold threads. And somehow in there you had to put the words lost connections in your native language. And then you had to add in a symbol that for you somehow represented that country, whether it was personal or whether it was sort of a country emblem as such. Anywho, I did start all that. I was almost sort of well over halfway through it, and I had an email from Alice, and she said, "Oh, I just realised you're stitching in blue. It had to be on an ivory ground." And
oops.
So there you go. Oops. I would never put gold on ivory to start this. Had I read it, I probably wouldn't have entered, but there we go. So my problem was one of my favourite ways and how I transfer all my embroidery designs is with a very fine permanent ink pen, Pigma pens, acid-free Pigma pens. So, of course, I had written these words all over my design. And at first I just put it aside thinking, well, this is not, I'm not going to do anything with it. What a waste of time that was. And I then ended up redesigning it in a way so that I could cover up the lettering, and I probably like it better now than the original version. So it's all worked out in the end.
Yeah, no, it was just an interesting read in that process that, all right, now I can't get rid of these words and I have all this work in. How do I make that go away but end up with something that works visually? And and how you worked that out was just fascinating to me, because you pulled it off. I mean, it worked. And because I thought, well, this is good. That's going to be tough, because permanent ink, I mean, you've got to be over it to hide it. And it was just an interesting experience. And it really gave some insight into the whole process, not only of design, but adjusting your needlework on the fly, basically.
Mm. I think that one of the things I really love about needlework, but also in other things I engage in, is the problem solving. Now, how do I do this and how do I make it work? That's the part of it, of the process, that I get not sleepless nights over, but that's the way my mind works. It is the problem solving. And I guess part of that, the early stages of that, was when I did work at the Ecclesiastical Art Society, is that the way their textile room works is their designs are not made by embroiderers or textile artists. They have artists who often will work in completely different media, design vestments that then has to be translated into stitch at the workroom. So you get in drawings and you stitch up samples to present to these designers, saying, is this how you envisage that this colour pencil drawing will look in textile? And that's the process. I look out the window and I go, oh, that bush over there. Now, is that a French knot, or is that a group of James? And that's how my mind just sort of tends to translate. How do I express that texture or that item in stitch? And getting back to the mermaid, it was a matter of, I don't want a solid border around her. So I need to find a way to blur that over that lettering without becoming a solid ring around it. And that's how that all came about.
Yeah, see, that interesting process is the bush French knots, because when I used to do a ton of photography, and a wizened veteran taught me that there's photography in the camera, but then there's photography that goes on throughout the day. In that, when you look at an object, put it mentally in a frame and say, all right, how would I execute this? What would the lighting be? Even if it's just a simple twig, what would you do with that? And keep training your mind to work on that. And then that will start to translate into your actual images, because you'll start seeing those things that you normally wouldn't see. And so when you said, is that bush a French knot? I thought, yeah, I know that procedure. Yeah.
And then that, again, is whatever context that would push. It's a never ending. But, yes, so it is the problem solving of embroidery that I really love. And I guess that, again, is another reason why I tend to work in a variety of techniques. And because I might be working on a piece of stump work and I'm doing something and I'll go, oh, hang on a minute, if I do this in crawl wool on a much larger scale, I can use it for such and such. So you have those experiences that then become a backbone for what you do next. So it moves and changes all the time. What you learn in one piece kind of carries into the next, or you'll draw on later.
Talk about your techniques, because you locked me right in when I saw that you use a slate frame. I really have to buy a slate frame someday and give it a try. Just that intrigues me in the process of setup. And then to me, I just see that ground cloth is just so taut that that it doesn't move much at all, and you can really get your tension just right. Does everything go on a slate frame, or does it depend?
No, that depends on size and what I am doing and how much time I have to do it, admittedly, at times too. I do prefer to stitch in slate frames if I can, but admittingly, most of my stump work and gold work pieces, because of their sizes, they're relatively small, I will do in hoops. Mm-hmm. But I am, there are ways to keep and maintain a really, really tight tension in your hoop. So things like binding both the inner and the outer ring, if you're working with silks or layered fabrics, make sure you have a good quality hoop. And that's one of the things I often see in classes. You know, you get your hoops with your very thin little metal brackets on them. You need to, if you want to keep your fabric tight, you really need to invest in one that has the good solid brass brackets so they don't bend when you tighten your hoop and those sorts of things. And I guess when you mention tension, the one thing to remember when you're stitching in a hoop is try to don't rest your hand on your fabric, because you will instantly loosen it. Just mm-hmm. a little bit of weight from your hand. So there are ways. But getting back to what I prefer, I do love my slate frame, from the point of view that it does keep it incredibly taut and I don't have to pull it in and out. It just sits there until it's finished.
Yeah,
and it's not. I know a lot of people are not. You know, the setting up is something that you just need to get over and done with. I mean,
yeah, that looks like it's a procedure.
It is a bit, but even with the hoop, by the time you're setting up your ordinary fabric, by the time you put your zigzag edges on whatever to stop your fabric fraying, and you get it in the hoop, and you get your pattern on, a lot of people sort of see that part of the process as something that just needs to get over and done with. I'm not a sports person by any stretch of the imagination, but I imagine for me it's like a sports person warming up. It's an important part of the whole process. You need to, and it gives me time to just get my head around what I'm about to do. Putting on the pattern itself, it's sort of that, it's another way of becoming nice and familiar with what I'm about to stitch, because I have to get these lines on there, need to get them on neat. And with the crewel work that I'm working on at the moment, I don't think there was an image up yet, but with my crewel work, for instance, I don't ever trace them on a solid line. I'll mark them on as lines of dots, so similar to if you have a pounce that's gone through before you ink over it, you just have these rows of little dots, because they're much easier to cover than a solid line. So there's little things like that. So I'll sit and do for an hour or two, chill out and just make dots.
Yep.
So to me, the setup is just as much a process of the whole embroidery. I think the part I struggle with the most is the finishing. Once the embroidery is finished, the framing up or making it into something, by then I've usually lost interest. I'm terrible. Once the embroidery is done, I'm finished with it. I move on to the next.
I think that's
the hardest part, is the finishing off. That I struggled with that.
Yeah, I saw that one where you had dots, and I wondered if that was prick pounce or if it was actual ink dots. So you literally just dot with ink then.
Yes, and I guess that one came about in Denmark. Rather than pounce, you still, for sort of the traditional, or let's call old way of transfer, similar start as the prick and pounce, so you still have the tracing paper with lots of tiny little dots along the rows, but along the design lines. But rather than a pounce, we use a permanent ink that comes in a tin. It looks a little bit like a shoe polish, but the ink in there is really hard. So you then have a felt pad similar to your pouch pad that you dip in kerosene to get a bit of ink and then rub it over the ink. So you've got a colour, and you then rub this permanent ink through your pricking. which is really scary the first time you've got a piece of really expensive fabric. And there you are with kerosene and permanent ink, and it's, you go, oh, my goodness. But what it does is it gives you some beautiful...
Oh, man, I can't even imagine that.
The first time I had to do it, I think, was a piece of very, very expensive silk brocade. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, if I mess this up, I'm going to be in so much trouble. But the beauty of it is that once you have put this ink through your pricking, you lift your tracing off and you've got these beautiful, beautiful, delicate line of dots. You don't have to paint over it. You leave it. The ink sets pretty much straight away and you're ready to go. So you don't have that second process as in prick and pounce where you then have to paint over afterwards. It's there. It's done. I believe the same process is used in other places in continental Europe. They use the same in Germany. I know of a woman from Turkey who was showing the same thing. So I'm not sure whether it's all through continental Europe, but that was the most common method for transferring designs. But anyway, getting back to why I draw on my crewel, I only do it for crewel. The stump work and the gold is too small. That is still solid lines. But the crewel I will sit and just draw tiny, tiny dots along my design lines rather than solid lines.
It's interesting to me that when you talk about the setup and procedure, because for me too, I have that same feeling. It's just kind of satisfying to gather the things and get the threads organized. And there's something to that process that is, because you can just sit there and relax and organize yourself. And it's fun to do.
Yeah, I think for me, it's a nice way of sort of the last step of becoming familiar with what I'm embarking on. Having said that, I guess it's different when you're designing and creating something from scratch, because if I sit and I have to follow a knitting pattern, I'm probably like the stitchers who follow my embroidery patterns. I just want to get into it. I don't want to have to mess around with anything beforehand. I just want to do it. So I do understand that when you're following somebody else's instructions, it's a different mindset, I think, than when you're creating something for the first time and you're not following anything, you're not following any rules, you're just doing.
I was really surprised to see dollhouse needlework, because you don't see that very often. I mean, there's a couple, three people I've run across that do it a lot. But I was really surprised to see that you do that. I mean, that is minuscule stuff.
Well, it's something that you've been in looking at my doll's house as well, from what I can hear.
Yeah. I told you. I spent some time on you.
It's relatively new that I started building a doll's house a few years ago. My husband was very unwell, and I think I just needed something to distract me. So I started building this, in some terms, very simple doll's house. But to me, the thing when I stitch is that, as I said, a vast majority of it goes to classes and workshops and kits. So that means when I stitch, it's very different to when you pick up somebody's pattern and you follow that. You don't have to, it's all there for you, the colours, whatever. When you're creating a design that somebody else is later going to reproduce, the stitching process is very, very different. I have to take notes the whole time. I really have to remember, now, is there a reason why I'm stitching this from top to bottom, not the other way around? And if there is, I need to make a note of that so that can be reproduced. I need to keep it the way I make my kits. I don't include full skeins, for instance, in all kits. Most of them I will have the required amount of thread plus X amount to make sure there's enough for a little bit of reverse stitching from time to time. So I have to keep track of how many strands I use of each colour. So there's a lot of admin work, I suppose you could call it, attached to the actual stitching. And I have to think about it the whole time. So with the miniatures, I've always been fascinated by dolls' houses and miniatures. My grandmother had a fabulous one. But again, the things about it that intrigues me is, how do I make something that looks like the real thing, but in 1/12 scale?
Right.
So I started doing this while my husband was unwell, because I didn't have to think about it. Yeah. It was something I could just do to take my mind away from everything else. And I didn't have to present it to anybody. It was just for me. But it's I have fun with it sometimes. it's a good distraction from, because embroidery has become, it is a job. I think someone, when I told them that I had started building miniatures, saying, "What, you need a hobby? I thought you had a hobby." I love my stitching, don't get me wrong, and I will never stop stitching. But it's not a hobby as in something I go and do in my spare time. It's my full-time job. So I need something from time to time that I can go and just relax and do something for me.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the... the old the cobbler's kids have no shoes or whatever it is.
You do that
all day and you get home and No, I don't want to. I just don't want to.
And it was that. It was part of that. I was finding that I was working on embroidery. And when I say I work on embroidery all the time, I think the other thing that people are not aware of is that when it becomes a business as such, when it becomes your job, I probably spent over 3/4 of my time packing kits on the computer, doing admin, writing, because I do all my own instructions, I do all my own photography, I do all my own graphics. So I spend probably only 1/10 of my time stitching. Mm-hmm. And I was finding that I ended up doing computer-based work around the business during the day, and then I would stitch at night and I would never have any time out. It was ongoing, and you can only do that, I think, for so long. You need, well, I do anyway, I need time out where I go, okay, work time's over, now it's me time. So that's where the miniature come in. And I'm not a television watcher, I'll go and do something. So that's where the Doll's House came in. I would put embroidery aside, and I can play with glue and paint. It's wonderful. So something completely different, still creative and still making things and still engaging in stuff I find interesting.
Right.
But completely different.
Right, gives you that escape.
Yeah, which is really nice.
Yeah. Anna, this has been fun. Thank you so much.
It has been. It's been lovely.
Yes.
It's been really good fun.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And awesome. As with so many, there's so many more things that we have to talk about, so you'll have to come back. That's just the way it is.
Oh, that'll be fun. That would be fun. But thank you again so much. It's been really good fun to chat and sort of a good, as I said to you in my emails, when other people put it to you, you suddenly start realizing, oh, yeah, I have done a bit, I suppose.
Yes, you have.
So it's been good. It's been a good eye-opener for me, and I hope it's inspired. When you said to me about the designing, that is one thing that I'm really passionate about, and also in when I am out teaching, is to encourage people to just try other things and change things. If you feel like changing something in one of my patterns, go for it, because it's yours. So I'm glad we had a good chat about designing.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you very much, and thanks to everybody for listening. Yes.